Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how most of what we buy and consume helps prop up dictatorships and systems of oppression, and some ways to start changing this. With us is Leif Winar. He's chair of philosophy and law at King's College London and author of the book Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Leif Winar. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. I'm glad to be here.
A fascinating book, Blood Oil. You have traced the making of so many of our things, really, in fact, just about everything that we use, built upon these natural resources in multiple places, all pulled from Mother Earth. You open with the mobile phone. Do you want to walk us through a little bit of that first, and then we'll expand that into other things?
It's true. You know, these wonderful devices that we carry around with us that do so much for us, that we text with and talk into and game on, we don't tend to think that these are all natural resources, and the natural resources come from specific places on our Earth. The thing about the natural resources that go into our phones is that on the other end of the world's supply chains, there's often something called the resource curse. It's a fact about our world, which is surprising, that countries that are very rich in natural resources are often full of very poor people and authoritarians and militias and corruption. The resource curse is a serious problem in our world, and that's what this book is about.
So let's go into a description of the supply chain that you did in the book. You had a beautiful description of it that is really connected to everything we wear, everything we use, and each of these has its own supply chain. Can you walk us through some examples?
Sure. So if you think about the circuitry in your cell phone, well, where did the molecules to make up that circuitry come from? Probably from all over the world. It could be that somewhere, say, in the solder of your circuitry, there's some tin that came from the Congo, and it might have gone from there to a smelter in Thailand and then manufacturing plant, perhaps in China, and then shipping all through the world supply chains to where you are. That means that whoever took out that little piece of metal from the ground at the other end of the world is in business with you, and you are sending some of your money back to them when you buy products like a cell phone or other electronics, a laptop, game station, whatever it is. Because of globalization, we are in business with people all over the world, and the surprising thing is that especially in places that have a lot of resources, we're often unintentionally in business with very aggressive and violent and repressive people who are selling off the natural resources at the other end of the supply chain.
Now, you said this is even things like the clothes we wear.
That's right. I hate to say we think that we buy a lot of oil when we pay at the pump, but when it comes to oil, in fact, the biggest of all natural resources that's traded across borders, we're buying oil all the time, even when we don't think about it. So if you buy any clothes that are made with artificial fabrics, you're buying oil. And I'm just going to say anything that is plastic is made out of oil. And it's not only that. Oil is in the creams we smear on our face, in our cosmetics. It might be in our shoes. It might be helping your sex life. I mean, oil is everywhere in our lives. And we pay for oil all the time, which again means that whenever we go to the checkout, we may be sending some of our dollars and pounds and euros to men who consider themselves to be our enemies.
And you use this phrase, say, the resource curse. How exactly would you explain what we mean by the resource curse? You would think it would be a blessing.
You would. And in some countries, it is a blessing. I can explain what the difference is between the countries that are blessed and cursed by natural resources. But just to get a sense of how bad the resource curse is, especially for oil, the big resource, I can put it this way. You can think about all the great progress that the developing world has made over the last generation. And think of the great rise of China and India and South America and even many parts of Africa, but not the oil-producing countries. The oil-producing countries in the developing world are no more rich, they're no more free, and they're no more peaceful than they were even in 1980. That's remarkable. In these countries, oil is not a blessing, it is a curse.
And it is a curse because?
It's a curse because of one very old and very bad law at the international level that we take entirely for granted because it's been around for so long, but which is causing a tremendous amount of trouble in our world and that we now need to reform if we possibly can. This is the rule in all of our countries that say we will buy oil and other resources from whoever in other countries can control those resources by force. So if an authoritarian regime can keep a country under its cosh, we'll buy the oil from them. If a militia can get some tin out of the ground at gunpoint in the Congo, well, it'll be legal for us to buy that tin eventually from them. Our rule, the rule of the world for resources, is might makes right, and that's what puts us into business with these aggressive and oppressive actors overseas.
Now, is this rule essentially embedded in international law, or is this an unwritten rule?
It's an unwritten rule, and if you're an international lawyer, let me just say that there is nothing in international law that requires us to use this rule. So we are all sovereign countries, and we can make our own rules for who we think we should be buying resources from. Now, the rule that we use now, we've used it for a long time, we take it for granted, but if you think about it, it makes no sense. I mean, Marie, if you and I get some guns and go take over a petrol station down the street, no one thinks that you and I should get the legal right to sell off the gas, the petrol, and keep the money. But if you and I got some guns and took over the government of Angola, the next day you and I would have the right to sell the oil of Angola to all importing countries. So the rule of might makes right makes no sense when you think about it. It's a rule that we all use, but it's a rule that all of our countries have the right to change, and we should change it now.
So let's back up just a little bit and get more into some of the details that you laid out in the first part of the book as well. And then I'd like to come back to this, particularly as we talk about ways in which this whole process can change. But I'd really like to give a sense of how intertwined this whole thing is and how deep it really is. And maybe one place to start digging a little deeper is how much of these natural resources do we use? You described how much aluminum and steel and wood and copper we use as a humanity. How can we get an understanding of the scope of this?
It's hard. You know, there are more than 7 billion people alive right now, 7 billion human beings, each with the desires of every day to consume, to work, to have a house over their heads. The resources we use are just gigantic in their scale. So if you could imagine a gigantic block of iron crashing down on the ground once a second, a block of iron that weighs 50 tons, that's how much iron the world uses every second. And with oil, it's even more. It's hard to get a sense of how much oil we use right now. Put it this way, the world uses 1,000 barrels of oil. That's 42,000 gallons of oil every second. You can just imagine 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of this black goo disappearing in a shower of tiny sparks every second. 90% of the world's transportation works on oil. Almost every plane, train, car, boat, it's all oil-powered. We don't think about it much, but the world, humanity, uses gargantuan amounts of natural resources every single second of the day.
And you've said in your book in the early pages that this is actually more than just being addicted to oil and that there's more to it.
We are addicted to oil. It would be hard to keep 7.5 billion people alive right now without the oil. And let me just say, to solve the problem of the resource curse, the oil curse in particular, we should get off fossil fuels as quickly as we possibly can and get onto alternative sources of energy. But that's going to take a while, because we do need this combustible mud to keep our transportation systems going right now, and we use natural gas to heat our homes and to make electricity and so on. So we have to transition away from fossils. We have to cure ourselves of our addiction to oil, but it is going to take a while. And the other side of the addiction is, of course, the countries that have oil. There, it's not that the people are addicted to oil so much as the leaders are addicted to our money that we pay for oil. So we get the oil, we send our money in to the Saudis, the Iranians, the Qataris, and so on, and they use our money to keep themselves in power by buying the muscle and the loyalty they need to divide and rule. So they're addicted to our money just as much as we're addicted to their oil. It's a mutually assured addiction, and that's something we really have to stop because it's so dangerous.
And it's a little bit paradoxical, too, this idea that these resource-rich countries are actually in some ways becoming less peaceful and more poor when you look at the population as a whole, while many states that are not oil producing, they're getting richer, they're getting freer and more peaceful. How do we explain this?
So here is the big fact that everyone can remember. Oil is the largest source of absolute power in the world. In our world, because we say might makes right, whoever can keep coercive control over oil wells will get a big funnel full of money from the world as if it was just coming down from the sky. They can use that money for whatever purposes they want, and in non-democratic countries, sometimes the money will go to a militia like ISIS or these militias we've seen in Libya. They can use our money to buy more weapons, to pay for more soldiers. And sometimes our money goes to an authoritarian regime like we've seen over the years with Saddam and Gaddafi, or now still the Saudis, who have used our money not only to repress their own population, but also to spread this extreme, intolerant version of Islam around the world that we now see mutating into jihadi extremism, not only in the Middle East and Asia, but also in the West. So oil is a tremendous source of unaccountable power in our world, and that's why it's so dangerous, not only to the people of the oil-producing country, but eventually to us too.
One of the things you point out is that it seems like it's almost inescapable that we as consumers cannot be part of this. Now, on one hand, we don't see the devastation when we go and buy a new blouse or a new pair of pants or a new pair of shoes. It just looks like a perfectly legal transaction. But you say unless we buy our food in an organic Amish farm, really our shopping is saturated with oil at every stage. So what about the individual consumption?
You know, there are ways that consumers can help to convince our leaders to get us out of this terrible business of buying blood oil whenever we go shopping. There's a website called Clean Trade, cleantrade.org. And if you go to Clean Trade, you'll see there are strategies that consumers can use. For example, at Clean Trade, there'll soon be an index of the big oil companies. You can check which ones are doing more business with authoritarian regimes. And when you need to fill up your car with petrol, well, you can go to a company that does less business with authoritarians. There's also some boycotts we can use to help convince our Chinese friends not to buy oil from these authoritarian countries. Consumers can help to put pressure on our leaders to change this business that we're in, but eventually it has to be a political change. We do need to change our own laws in our own countries to say all of the people in our country will no longer be in business with these aggressive and oppressive actors overseas. We just don't want to buy oil from those guys anymore and send them our money with which they're causing so much trouble.
Now, in terms of foreign policy, you noted that, yes, while there's so much power wrapped up in the oil industry and these supply chains, these oil companies are not quite as influential as we tend to think they are. It sounded like you're a little bit more pluralistic in showing that there are these multiple influences, including geopolitical considerations. But you mentioned even the small NGO can make an impact.
You know, it's really funny, Maria. I've been getting more optimistic over the past 10 years as I've been doing this research about the changes that can be made even against very powerful actors. Now, big oil companies are doing what they do, and they've done a lot of questionable deals overseas, and they are very powerful at home. But if we're convinced that we need to make a change, we can win battles. Even small NGOs have won big battles. Let me give you an example of that. Everyone in this part of the world knows that we need more transparency around oil. It's totally opaque to the people of oil-producing countries how much their government is getting for the oil that's being sold off. But, of course, the big oil companies did not want to be more transparent about the deals they were making. There was an NGO over here that convinced a couple of American senators that it would be a good idea to have more transparency in the oil industry, and they produced a bill which went nowhere at first because oil was so strong. But then the window of opportunity came, and it happened to be that terrible big oil spill you might remember in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. It was a terrible spill, but the silver lining was that that summer the oil industry's lobbyists couldn't get their phone calls returned in Washington because oil was just toxic. The senators reintroduced their bill, and it passed, and it required all American oil companies to become more transparent. And the really inspiring thing about this story is once the United States required transparency of its companies, well, then Europe put in the same requirement, and Norway, and now Canada, and there's a real movement throughout the West to require that transparency of oil companies. We didn't think we were going to get that for 10, 20 years, but now it's law in all of these countries. Progress can happen if we have our stuff ready to go. The window of opportunity will open.
It's interesting you just mentioned Norway, and you mentioned Norway in the book as well as an example of a resource-rich country that is not the resource curse. Why is that?
So this is what I mentioned before. There is a distinction between countries where resources are a blessing and resources are a curse. Norway is doing so well with its oil. You can imagine that the pension funds there are filled for decades in advance, and it's very good on gender equality, public services. Norway is doing spectacularly well with its oil wealth, and why? It's because Norway was a country where the government was accountable to the people when the oil first came in. When the government is accountable to the people, then of course the people force the government to use the oil money for public goods. And that's when oil can be a blessing. The oil money goes to strongmen or militias. That's when oil can be a curse. And that's why we see such troubles in this arc of oil from Russia through the Middle East into Africa. That's where oil came in, where the government was not accountable to the people, and that's where the curse sets in so severely.
So that's the curse on the side of the human effect. Of course, we're also simultaneously dealing with the climate effect, which would imply that even when oil is a blessing on the human effect in the case of Norway, it may still be a curse for the planet's overall health.
That is definitely true. And as I said, we should get off fossils as quickly as we feasibly can. We just have to do both of these things at once. I mean, think about the big stories that came out of Paris last autumn. One story was the climate negotiations, which were at least a bit more hopeful than Copenhagen had been. And the other story was those terrible attacks in Paris by ISIS operatives. We just have to try to tackle both of these problems at once. The growth of climate change, the spread of violent extremism, they're both difficult problems, but the movements can work together. The best strategy really is an autocrats to alternatives plan for energy for all of our countries. We can work together and get a win-win solution on energy for both.
So let's keep going down this solution path that you've been laying out. You were talking about the international rule, and you've talked about this idea of effectiveness.
Effectiveness is the fancy lawyer's word for might makes right. So this just is the bad old rule left over from centuries ago that says we will buy oil and other resources from whoever can control it by force in other countries. So, for example, when Saddam Hussein took over Iraq in a coup, the world started buying oil from him. And then years later, when ISIS took over those same wells, well, the world made it legal to buy oil from ISIS. Our default rule is effectiveness. It is might makes right. And that is what's driving violence and oppression overseas. When we say the most coercive men in a country will get our money, well, then, of course, the most coercive men will fight to get on top and use our money to stay on top.
Are there any constraints in international law or none at all?
No, we can change our own laws on our own soil for our own people. And in fact, the really hopeful thing is that we don't have to invent any new or international organizations. We don't have to sign any new treaties. All we have to do is get our own country's laws to line up with principles that we already deeply believe in. The big principle is just the intuitive one that we believe already, which is a country belongs to its people. Right, a country belongs to its people. Over here in America, Abraham Lincoln said it in his inaugural address. A country belongs to its people, and that means that it's the people, and not just coercive power, who should have the ultimate right to say what should happen to the resources in a country. That's a principle we already believe. Leaders around the world already speak this language. A country belongs to its people. The oil belongs to its people. And best of all, there are already major treaties signed where it says, in Article 1 of both the Human Rights Covenants, for example, all peoples shall, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources. So the bad old rule of effectiveness might makes right is causing all of this trouble in the world. And the better modern rule that all countries belong to their people is already deeply embedded in the global culture. Leaders talk the talk. The treaties are already signed. We just have to align our own laws with this principle we all already believe to make progress against might makes right.
And that would be country by country, you're saying?
That's right. And any country can be a leader in this regard. New Zealand certainly is well placed to be a leader. New Zealand could go clean trade tomorrow by passing an act saying, we will, on a certain date, no longer be purchasing oil from any government which is not minimally accountable to its people. And I do mean minimally. You don't have to be Norway to sell oil, you know, with the consent of the people. It's basically just asking, can the people find out what's happening to their resources? And if a majority strongly dislikes what the government is doing, could the majority stop what the government is doing? Minimal civil liberties and political rights. If a government is not accountable to its people in that minimal extent, well, then by our own principle that a country belongs to its people, we shouldn't be buying that oil.
Is this what you are calling the clean trade framework?
That's right. Clean trade is the framework, and I said cleantrade.org is online. It really is a couple of laws. We should just pass a law saying that peacefully, deliberately, gradually, we are going to taper off our imports of all authoritarian oil, and then we'll pass a second set of laws to try to encourage the big Asian importers, for example, like China and India, also to announce that they will be stopping buying authoritarian oil at some point in the future.
I know you're advocating for minimizing our use of these non-renewable resources, and you use some examples in the book about how much depletion there really is on these non-renewable resources. And I think you used Cyprus as an example, a country that used to be rich in copper and now has nothing left. Are we facing at some point what used to be called peak oil? Are we facing a complete depletion of this natural resource?
Anyone who tells you that they know what the future of oil is very optimistic. Predictions about oil are notoriously difficult. And when I started this book 10 years ago, the talk was of peak oil. We would soon run out. And then the shale revolution started in the United States, and now peak oil is not much talked about. The thing that's almost undeniably true is that we're not running out of oil so much as running out of cheap oil. The easy oil in the world is draining down, and the oil that we're now accessing is harder and harder and more expensive and more environmentally dangerous to extract. So we're not running out of oil, but we're running out of cheap oil, and the oil that we're getting is much dirtier to extract. So it really is time to start transitioning away from fossils to cleaner sources of energy.
You know, you make another interesting point. The United States is an oil-producing country at this point because of the fracking and the shale oil that you were just describing. Would you call it one of these resource-rich countries?
Sure. The United States is a major energy producer. It has been for a long time. The energy of the United States, especially the fossils, powered it through the 20th century, helped it become a great economic power. Oil, other resources in the United States are very significant in their absolute volume, but as a percentage of the economy, they're quite small, maybe 2, 3% of GDP. It's about the same as restaurants, say. So oil in the United States, other minerals, It's not a big part of the economy, and that's why, along with being democratic, oil doesn't curse the United States very much. It's a similar story in, say, Canada, the UK. Australia, as you know, has enough natural resources that it did better than other Western countries during the recent financial crisis. So if you have a moderate amount of resources as part of your GDP, well, then resources can contribute to the economic activity. It's really when you get most of your economic activity coming from oil, especially if you're non-democratic, that's when trouble starts to set in.
So let's now look back at the solutions that you're proposing, for example, the laws that could be enacted in the purchasing countries. Is there a downside to refusing to buy from these oil-rich, resource-curse countries in which people, even the very poorest, may be desperate to have even pennies from? Or are you suggesting that it will force these dictatorships to reform?
It will encourage dictatorships to reform. If they're losing their customers for the oil, then there will be a more responsive government in power before long. But about the people who are poor in these oil-producing countries, you know, I take this so seriously, and I've studied this quite a bit. In order to convince yourself that we need to change the way we do business for oil and other resources, you just have to look at the resource curse seriously. I mean, look at that statistic that I gave you not so long ago. Oil-rich countries are no richer than they were in 1980. That's a remarkable fact, and there's a great deal of extreme poverty in many of these oil-producing states. You can think of the big ones in Africa, you know, Nigeria, Angola, and so on. Angola, there's a fantastically rich, corrupt regime living extravagant lifestyles, while it's also the worst place in the world to be a child. It's the highest child mortality rates in the world in Angola. So oil, other resources in these countries, in general, is not helping the poor. It really is an impediment to development in so many places. And that's why we have to make the governments more responsive to the people of the country, do everything we can to encourage governments to become more responsive to the people of the country so that the people can get more of the benefits of the natural resources of their country.
Leif Winard, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Maria, and I thank you so much for having me on.
The name of the book is Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Rule the World. Leif Winard is the Chair of Philosophy and Law at King's College London.